CliffCentral.com.
All right, it is time. Oh, what's going on there? Pumelele.
Yeah, bo.
Oh, are you there? Okay. We're going to be talking. Just checking. I think you were already starting the conversation in the studio there. But that's cool.
No, not at all. Not at all. We were just shooting the breeze.
All right. Well, we're going to introduce you to our guest in just a moment. It is time for us to check in on the Burning Platform for this week. And lots of things worthy of discussion. Popalatse, Chris Hani's killer, Yanis Vallis being granted parole, Cyril doing a state visit to the UK. Who is in the ANC's top six and who's in line for the top six? And we've got a bunch of other stuff to discuss as well. But first, let me introduce our guest, Lukhona Mnguni, who is a governance, politics, and development specialist. He currently serves as the head of policy and research at the Rivonia Circle, which, Pums, I know you've been trying to get someone from the Rivonia Circle on for a while. We've had, obviously, a while ago, we had Songeza Zibi on. But this morning, it is great to welcome Lukhona. How are you, Lukhona? Nice to see you.
Very good morning, and good morning to you, and good morning to your listeners. It's actually quite fantastic to join you. I must say, Pumelele did drag me. Like, yeah, I've been looking for you guys for some time. I know we are here. Now we are here.
All right. So tell us, just for those people who don't know it all, about the Rivonia Circle, so we can start there and you can just refresh our memories, because it has been a while since we had Songeza on.
No, and even before, but I think I must say, I must defend myself and say, I am not the person who dragged him, right? Mm-hmm. We had one of the listeners put a message out on Twitter, And he said, we should get these people on. And I said, we've been trying. This is how. So now he feels dragged. I just want to say. I was just responding honestly to a listener. Right.
All right. So,
well, I mean, we're here now. Those house rules.
So we're here now, and it is water under the bridge. Tell us about the Rivonia Circle. You've got something interesting and exciting happening at the moment, even.
Yeah, I mean, look, we sought out to found the Rivonia Circle to be a political think tank that would close space that we felt existed in our political landscape. Political parties over time have alienated a lot of South Africans, because generally about 93% to 94% of the voters are not even members of political parties. Mm-hmm. And so it means in between elections, political parties spend so much time servicing their membership base, you know, fighting and thugging it out on factional warfare and all of that. And the voters remain quite unserviced outside of the processes, which are always shoddy, of public participation by municipal council, provincial legislatures, and parliament. Mm-hmm. And so what we thought was missing in the political landscape was an overtly political think tank in its outlook, which does not, you know, rely on doing research in an air-conditioned office, but would seek to go to communities and galvanize people back to democratic participation. And of course, we've been now, we're just about 11 months into the work of the Rivonia Circle. We officially launched in January 2022. We thought we were doing what we called a soft launch, and we're going to do a big launch in March. But the traction that just, you know, came from that soft launch made it impossible for us to say we are going to launch again. People had given us the runway. And we've been doing, we'll get into the nitty-gritties, but we've been doing work in communities. We've been to almost 40 communities now across 8 different provinces. And in those communities, we do programs like the Democracy Builder, Political Theater, and different convenings to get people's insights. And of course, we've done 2 surveys. You might have seen one of our surveys lately, which we did with Ipsos, 2,000 registered voters. We did 1,000 in December last year. We've done multiple mm-hmm. focus groups. I think we are now on 26 focus groups. So we've been trying to understand the political landscape of South Africa and the politics of South Africans and what they are looking for going into the future.
So Gareth earlier in the show was musing about civic education and making people take a test. Maybe this is, you must engage here, Rivonia Circle can make those tests.
Well, we've got a different conception to civic education. We call it civic conversations, because we felt that people sometimes, when they talk of civic education / voter education, it moves from the premise that, you know, people don't know enough. Sure, they might not know enough about technical issues. What does Section 89 of the Constitution say? Therefore, you know, the process to quote unquote impeach the president. But you've got to start where people are with the conversation about their own politics, their own conception of politics. There are so many things that have made people check out of politics, of governance. I mean, when we do the Democracy Builder, for example, we put out four words. We don't make presentations. Say, what does politics make you think of? And people say deal making, corruption, poverty, and all of this.
Yeah.
So people are actually they have a view about what their politics are and the things they don't like about their politics. So it's quite fascinating to have that, you know, two-way conversation. Rather than going to educate them, because I think on the more technical aspects, all of us would probably fail one test or the other.
Well, yeah, and what an indictment on us.
This is exactly what Gareth.
Yeah, what an indictment on us that is. I mean, that's really just the saddest thing, right, Pumi? Because it means that we want and expect so much from politics and from our political leaders, but we're not even prepared to learn about how the thing's meant to work. So I don't want to recover ground that we've already been over this morning, but I think that is something we've got to think about.
But so I'm very interested to know what, when you speak, when you have these conversations, what is the overwhelming response? So the number one, if you were to say of all the communities we've been to, the number one thing that people associate with politics.
Inefficiency.
Wow.
Inefficiency. It manifests in different ways. But the core thing that's associated with politics right now by many people is inefficiency. Whether that is expressed in terms of, you know, lack of service delivery, whether it's expressed in terms of people being left behind by the politicians, whether it's expressed as corruption, but at the heart of it is inefficiency. People really feel that politics have failed to be efficient and deliver on their promise. That's the one thing on the diagnostic. The overwhelming thing that's actually surprising, and that's why we've got a tag called the power to act. Because when we ask people to come up with a project to solve for something in their community, they really think deep and sometimes don't solve for the obvious. Give you an example about a community in Sterkspruit in the Eastern Cape. When they were asked to solve for, you know, a problem, I mean, Sterkspruit, even though saying local municipality comes out quite well in terms of audits, it's actually a very poor municipality. It's in the top 30 in terms of, you know, good audits and so on, but it's a very poor municipality. And you would think people would solve for poverty and so on. They wanted to solve for the safety of people who belong to the LGBTQI+ community. And it was quite a wow factor, but when you then think about it, the discrimination of people because of their sexual orientation and so on actually is affecting families, because those people belong to families. When those people are killed, families feel the pain and the brunt of that. When those people are, you know, discriminated and differentiated from the community and othered and all of that. So I'm trying to say one of the things that has amazed us is how people are ready to be catalyzed to solutions. And they really do believe after that conversation that they've got the power to act, but they're not being given the space to demonstrate that power to act, because it would be a threat to some and certain politicians.
Mm. So we sit here in studios and in our news, in our dinner parties in Joburg and Cape Town and all of that, and we're deeply concerned about what is happening with the ANC and with the factional battles that they have, and leading up to their conference, we know all the people that are
in the running
and the numbers that they are likely to get and all of that. Do people in those outlying communities care? Do they care as much as we do about those political factions?
They care about their own lot. They care about their opportunities being stunted. They care about, you know, the difficulty to make it to those dinner tables that you talk about, and that they have completely been left out of, you know, the country's development. And the truth of it is that those of us who can afford to, you know, be on those dinner tables, sit in studios like this, we form part of a very minority privileged grouping. And this is why I've been saying for some time, and I mean, I've had this conversation with different colleagues, whether it's Sizwe Mpofu-Walsh and others, and I've and I said it when I spoke at Diakonia in Durban 5 years ago in the build-up to the ANC conference then. And I said, you know, there's one thing that South Africans are just not preparing for. It's life beyond the ANC. I've been trying to highlight this for the last 5 to 7 years, that we actually have to start a very clear conversation. I asked one news editor and I said, what happens when the ANC no longer has 50%? How do you decide to deploy a reporter to their National Executive Committee meeting? Because it becomes a different and a new world. And I think sometimes, yes, because the ANC is governing, you can't avoid it. But I do think we overly obsess about, you know, the machinations within the ANC. And in part, it's probably our own system shock of denialism, that in actual fact, the ANC has disintegrated so much that it's become a danger and is harmful to society.
Yeah, a couple of, like, keywords which just make they immediately get my suspicions up when people use them, like when people suddenly cite the LGBT community to make the discussion seem a lot more valid and relevant, or when people talk about like the reporters in newsrooms, like no one's really reading newspapers the way that they used to, especially not young people. It's such an irrelevant conversation to young people compared to the effect of like social media, for example. And I often hear people talking about, you know, the interests of local communities, or, and it's Pat, I'm not saying this is for what you're saying at all. You know, Lukona, I get what you're trying to address here, and what the Rivonia Circle, I think, is going to do a very good job of, is making the real issues front and center. But I hear people paying lip service to all of these terms, and they don't really care about that stuff. Like, no one's actually asking people in small communities what they care about. No one's asking them. No one's even interested in them. When last did you ever see an unemployed person sit down and get an interview? Because they're not stupid people. You're not stupid. If you're unemployed, yeah, it's not because you're dumb. But instead, we'll sit and talk to Enoch Godongwana for like an hour and a half on some special current affairs program on TV. But no one's sitting and interviewing a smart unemployed person about what they go through every day, what they'd like to see in the economy, why they've stopped voting. No one's paying attention to those people. They pay lip service to them and they claim to have their mandate. You know, you even hear the unions sometimes saying, well, we speak on behalf of... No, you don't. You speak on behalf of the members who pay. And what you're doing is you're following and I'm cynical about this. I really am. I don't even make... I make no apologies for how cynical I am about it. These unions are just doing what they need to, the bare minimum they need to keep those member fees coming in so that they can keep investing in capitalist companies that they can pretend to hate on the other side of it, while making the leadership of the unions extremely rich. It's just bullshit, you know. And I hear about people going, oh, well, privilege this and privilege that. And they're exactly the same people who are so keen on getting themselves a little bit more of that privilege just so they can use the word and make other people feel bad.
So, Gareth, I mean, you are raising something very important, because it's about the legitimacy of voices. And you are touching on something that over 10 years ago I started, you know, contending with. And, you know, there's this term that as I grew in the academic space, you know, people would say, yeah, these are the voices of the voiceless. And I said, but this thing is not true. Nobody's voiceless. You just choose not to give them a space to voice out. And we were really being, you know, trained to believe that, you are the voice of the voiceless. And I had to really ask, exactly as you say, where do I get the mandate to speak on behalf of the voiceless? I don't.
What a cheek for people who are in academic institutions, which means they're in the top 2% of people in this country without any, even if you have student loans and you've got bursaries and you've got NSFAS or whatever it is. If you are in a university, you are among the luckiest and most privileged people in this country just by virtue of the fact that your backside is sitting in a university lecture hall. And you can then have the temerity and the cheek to speak on behalf of poor people who've never come to the university and said, please, will you speak on our behalf because you've got a degree or two. I mean, it's outrageous that these academics have the kind of ability to cast their opinions around like they're more than just a spoilt little kid. And sometimes they're not spoilt, but they're going to be on their way to being way better off than most people in this country.
Yeah. Look, the upward mobility is going to be there. And it is important that we give people space to dream about their country. So I'm going to go back to the work that we do in the Democracy Builder Program. There was one just yesterday in East London in a small community called Dukas. And another one today will be in Duncan. And 60 people pitched up, largely young people, at that Democracy Builder. There's a phase after we've put out the forwards of politics, government, governance, and democracy. We then invite people. You should see the floor maps that we get to do with sticky notes. So we give people 3 sticky notes and say, what are the 3 things you would solve for, given an opportunity, in your community and in South Africa? And then we do bar graphs of the issues. And we take the top 3 most pertinent issues and priorities of the community of people, and we say, in South Africa 2.0, how do these issues look like? And to the point that you're saying, Gareth, I mean, just because somebody's unemployed doesn't mean that they don't have views and ideas.
Or that they don't have skills. But just, can I stop you quickly? Because we get to your Eastern Cape story now.
Yep.
What were the big issues? This is what you're actually doing the research. You're asking people. So what were the 3 biggest issues?
In real time.
Yeah, that they brought up in those two.
It largely depends on in the community that you find yourself in. For example, communities in the Western Cape, Philippi, Khayelitsha, where we've done, you know, Democracy Builders, their biggest issue is service delivery, sanitation, mm-hmm. water, mm-hmm. electricity. Mm-hmm. But then we then group all of these into one column because generally they are service delivery issues. But it's unsurprising because the moment you drive into Philippi, you've got these portable toilets and people are squeezed together. So that is the immediate pressing need. But if you are in a community where, for example, like Alice, the biggest issue in Alice was education for people. It mm-hmm. was not housing because generally rural folks have land. They have some form of house. Mm-hmm. It might not be adequate, but they are not living in a shack.
There's formal housing in rural.
There's formal housing, right? So it's not their most pressing need. And there's connectivity of electricity as well in some villages. So then that removes them from the immediate front and center service delivery issues. So education became an issue. In a community in Fieblas in Qebega, their biggest issue was their local clinic because it kept opening, closing, reopening, closing. And they said it's also unsafe. It has long queues. And guess what? That community said they would like us to assist them with becoming a clinic committee. And they've been trained by the Department of Health now. There's a clinic committee in that community because of the Democracy Builder work. It's not a clinic committee that is outsourced from somewhere and brought into the community. It's self-originating from the community. So for them, health was a serious issue because here they had an institution, but it was not functioning properly because they felt there's no oversight enough to do that. So I'm trying to say, Gareth and Pumi, it depends where you find yourself in terms of what the pressing issues. In Toyando, their biggest problem was safety. And not surprising, one of the projects that came out of that Democracy Builder was a safety app. And this guy is about to team up with some big companies now to try and scale up and ramp up the impact and ability of that safety app. So I'm trying to say it's not just only about harvesting the issues. It's also about what are the kind of projects that come out of these Democracy Builders in communities, people finding solutions to their pressing problems.
Here's another problem. Nobody in the media is ever going to report on any of those issues you just talked about because they're boring and they're not clickbait. They would rather talk.
Of course.
They're
not Gwedemandashe shouting at Siri.
Right, exactly. So this is what's irritating me, is like the media has a responsibility in all of this. And I know you've got a show on ENCA, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you and I've got this platform. Pumi and I share this platform every Friday. We've got a responsibility to also start talking about the things real people care about instead of going for the stuff that we think is going to get us clicks and views and viral marketing of ourselves on social media. This is a big problem, and I blame massive news sites. I blame the old news organizations, the newsrooms, the journalists themselves who've become, you know, whores for clickbait as well. You're not actually talking about the shit people care about. This is maybe a reflection on me because I'm boring. Who knows? I had a conversation with two of my clever friends the other day. I said, what is government for? This is the kind of conversation I have for fun. You know, when other people are drinking and watching football, yeah. This is the kind of stupid shit I'm doing. So these two pretty intelligent friends of mine, we sat there for a little while, maybe no more than 20 minutes, talking about what the three top things that government should be doing are. We came up with just three things. You mentioned one already, service delivery. So this is something that both the people in Khayelitsha and Guguletu and all those places in the Western Cape are most concerned with, and that people who are living in suburbia like me are concerned with. So we have that in common. Number one is service delivery. Number two, we said, is maintaining and building and repairing infrastructure, as in government buildings, courthouses, you know, the electricity pipeline, roads, the fuel pipelines, the trains, the harbors. So basically infrastructure is number two, which is hugely important. Those are two vital functions of government. That's why we pay taxes. It's why we have a government. And the third one is secure borders, because if you don't have secure borders, or you don't know what your borders are, or you don't have some means of getting in and out of the country legally, you're not a country. You don't have sovereignty. You might as well tear down the fences. And we say, well, you know, Zimbabwe has equal rights to tell us what should go on in Limpopo as we do. Why not? So I think those are three massive, massive things. And we get caught in the reeds sometimes around, you know, health and education. You know, people are pretty resilient. And the people at the bottom of the pyramid in this country are not relying on government for health, for example, because they can't. They're looking after themselves. And they're setting up, Gareth, they're doing things like clinics. Yes, Pumps?
You're raising an interesting thing, which is what I pick up from what you're saying, Lukhona. So when you've had these engagements, self-organizing within the communities is then very important. So the power to act, the power to be in control and take on the solution or providing the solution from. But how are they supported? How do the communities then get further support? Because sometimes in some communities, I mean, if I think about the rural communities where I have ties, is they may not know what it is to run a health committee or a health or a safety app, you know. So how can we support them, or how do you support them, if at all?
Well, so we conceive of these projects as 6-week projects. We don't, I mean, it's resources to sustain some of these. But what we've actually found is that there are two big needs that people need support with. One is mobility. So if you can give them transport money to be able to move from their village to the nearest town to knock at a particular door to get certain things done, partly because transportation costs have just become so astronomic. I mean, crazy. I did the research in KZN in 2019 where we interviewed 1,000 people from rural towns across KwaZulu-Natal. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that came out was, I mean, there was a village where it cost about 70 rands or 90 rands from that village to the nearest town. And some people are just completely squeezed out and they don't have the finances for that kind of mobility. So one is to provide mobility. The second is to tap into technology. People have cell phones, so giving them airtime, data, and so on to organize things and organize themselves, that is also very important. Because sometimes I think when we think of support, we think big ideas. I can tell you we've not seeded any of the projects in the different communities at over 7,000 rands. And they've been seen to completion by people, because people then do what we were taught, at least when I was still a community development student. You know, we spoke a lot about asset-based community development, to say that development should start within galvanizing the assets that are within the community. Give you a story about Mahigeng. They wanted to solve for, you know, the issue of lack of income. And they didn't try and build a chicken run. They just went to a lady who has a chicken farm, but has a chicken building that she was not using. And they simply asked if they could use that and utilize it for their own ends. Those guys are now selling eggs. They call them Rivonia Circle eggs. But the point I'm trying to show is that there are assets within our communities, and we need to think carefully. I mean, Gareth is talking about what government should do to catalyze development, service delivery, infrastructure, you know, secure the borders. So you also have to ask, what are the things you can do in a community to catalyze the power to act? And I think, you know, questions around supporting mobility and accessibility,
just quickly,
they're very important.
Comrade, on a point of order, I was actually just saying, this is what government is for. I'm not saying this is what they should do. Like, this is the whole reason we bother to have one. Otherwise, we would just devolve into small anarchic kind of city-states or whatever.
Of course.
And in most of the country, that is the way that it's running anyway. You know, most of South Africa is not run by the national government, whether they like to believe it or not. There are parts of rural KwaZulu-Natal.
They don't even care about
doing it. They don't give a shit. Northern Cape, KwaZulu-Natal, Northwest Province, parts of Limpopo and Mpumalanga, certainly parts of the Free State, that have devolved into small fiefdoms that are either run by a gangster-in-chief or by the community themselves, where they're fixing their own water pipes, they're digging.
Like Harry Smith.
Correct. So we already know what this is. So when people go to the polls or don't, the central question is, why do we need a government? And that's why I asked that question about what are the three top things that government is there for? Because if we figure that out, we can also figure out, all right, well, what can we do without them? And what should we be doing for ourselves? And making it sustainable so that kids will be given opportunities to learn in education institutions, where people will be allowed opportunities to work, to make a meaningful contribution to society. And those are the kinds of things that become the big questions. I don't think we need politicians to solve those things for us. We must figure them out ourselves in think tanks and civil institutions like Pumi and you and I are talking about.
They must hand over the budget, though. I mean, that over a trillion red budget would come in handy in the hands of the people.
Never you will have to pry it from their cold, dead hands.
Yeah.
They will never hand it over. You will have to pry it from their...
It's the thing that they want. You know, I spoke to one veteran in the ANC ecosystem. And
sorry, we need a moment. Say that again. In the ANC
ecosystem.
Okay.
Yeah,
all right.
It's quite an ecosystem that works in different ways. So I said, so we're contending about this, how much money, you know, parties spend on elections now. He says, if it's a billion, think about it, you can spend a billion to buy access to 5 trillion rands over a term.
Yeah. Jesus.
And it's okay. And we don't see where this money goes. I mean, Brutus Malada wrote a piece last week in the Daily Maverick, and he spoke about, you know, the Gauteng problem for 2024 and how it's going to be tightly contested because there's 460 billion rands at stake that, you know, people want to control. This is a very big province. But to the point that, Gareth, you are making, I do want to push back a little, though, and say we do need to get to a point of our despondency with politics and politicians and political parties must not result in us giving up hope in the political system as a concept, because what it's going to do is it's going to leave the worst of the worst in that landscape, and we will still be paying our taxes. We're not going to check out on paying our taxes. We will still be paying our rates. We'll still be giving them the revenue in the your hands on a silver platter to misuse and abuse. But we've got to figure out these multiple ways of attack. And I think, as you have been saying, in certain places, go to Maluti Apufong. I mean, the ANC there did a mess of it. Councillors just wanted to get rid of a corrupt mayor of their party, and the party decided to get rid of the councillors. And of course, now those councillors contested as MEP 16 in the 2021 elections, and they're now governing through a coalition in that municipality with that collective of people who have been fixing things and so on. So I do think that there is still a need to battle and fight for the kind of people that we deserve to occupy political office. Because as both of you may know, I have said to some people, I've never seen a society that develops where the political elite and establishment is pulling one direction and the citizens are pulling another direction. Dr. Mampila Rampela in the scenarios, Dinokeng scenarios, they called it this thing of moving apart scenario. If there's a moving apart situation, unfortunately, there's not going to be a coherent and cohesive development. In our own little fiefdoms, as you call them, we may feel that we are okay. We are fairly fine.
Not gonna
work. But what about the solidarity of, you know, citizens and building a country? That you start losing that, and then you end up with no country at all. Like, I mean, countries like the Democratic Republic of Congo, they are not countries.
No.
They've got borders, but I mean, if you look at what is happening inside that country, I mean, Greg Mills and David Hebst have written quite interestingly on this. This is not a country. You can't say you have a country where you've had peacekeepers for, what, over 50 years?
Well, let's...
But also, you see, there are people all over the world running away from that country. Because it is not a country.
Yes, it can't afford them anything. And we're starting to see people running away from this country, correct, South Africa. Go to London. Go to London. It's now easier to bump into a South African than it was 6 years ago in London.
Right. We had
literally,
conversation
on the tube, on the bus, you can just tell, this one. You know, sometimes there are these baba with their hair and their beard from... KZN mostly. I was in London in September. I said, this one's from South Africa. I'll just say Sawubona, and he responds.
And it's not as if
it's become very easy.
And it's not as if those people who are going over to London are the people that we can afford to lose. And everybody deserves their place under the sun. But my God, we need engineers, we need doctors, we need people who can make things happen, and entrepreneurs. Yep. Why should we lose all of our most talented people to these other countries because the government can't do its job properly to keep them here?
And understand that those talented people, we had Kaya Sithole here telling us about a grouping that he is also, now you could bump into him on the metro over there in London, right? About a grouping of young black chartered accountants that they have now formulated over there in London.
And
this is the thing. So you've also got to get it over around your brain that the people we are losing are not a particular type of person. It is every type of person that we need to run and build our country.
You're quite correct. I mean, yesterday I bumped into Lawson Naidu on the health trade, and we spoke about this. Says he was in London. Kaya Sithole just put on a random Saturday a group of 8 people, all black professionals, architects, accountants, as Gareth is saying, engineers, and they were watching cricket, they were having drinks, and people are living the best of their lives. We are also losing some people to the companies that are beginning to establish their headquarters in Dubai. So there's quite a huge channel of people. And as you are saying, it's no longer a grouping. It's no longer a racial group thing. You know, it used to be like old white people are going. People in their late 20s, early 30s are believing that their career prospects don't lie and reside in this country. They are better off flighting and going elsewhere. And I saw something very weird on this issue on Twitter. There was a week where these people who have left were literally running threads about how comfortable they are and how to live. They were saying, no, now I've got state health care.
Right.
I don't have to worry. When I pay my tax, I know that my child is going to have transport. In actual fact, if you get pregnant here, and this is more around the Nordic countries in Europe, you'll get a stipend of some sorts
for 6 months
and so on. And it was like they were recruiting. I'm like, no.
Well,
what have we become if our own people are starting to speak like that?
You just see all those recruitment ads that are coming from all kinds of countries now when you go online. And they know that South Africans work hard and South Africans are prepared to drop everything and go. So they're advertising to us, and they can pick up real talent very quickly and cheap. So it's not
somebody
working
said
for
they
us.
Are denouncing. Somebody said they are now renouncing their South African passport.
Of course.
They'll take up citizenship that side, and it's fine.
If you're young and you haven't really established deep roots here and you don't see much of a prospect, why the hell wouldn't you is the question. And instead of Cyril, who's also in London at the moment, going over there to wine and dine with the new king, which I suppose is important.
And be carried on a carriage, somebody.
Well, I mean, have you seen those? Listen, first of all, that's all good. That's what the Brits do when someone comes to visit. It's fine. I'm glad that Cyril was the first official state visit for King Charles III. Whoop-dee-doo. But he is doing all of that stuff, which, of course, has its role. And there's something about that kind of summit international diplomacy crap that we kind of have to keep paying heed to, because there are occasionally important things that happen in those discussions. But by and large, what did you make of his visit? What would you like to see come from things like that in the future? Because it does cost us money to send Cyril and the delegation that he took with him to fancy state dinners and, you know, diplomatic receptions.
Has the presidency tweeted about what they're doing?
I don't know. I would love to know. What are our victory conditions for going to something like that? I'd love to just see, okay, well, we've got to establish these kinds of trade deals. Let's work on, you know, some process whereby they can help us to generate more power or whatever it might be. There's skills that maybe we should come to some arrangement over the South Africans who live. Maybe the South Africans who live there should be paying less tax here if they're working over there. Something, there must be some incentive structure that makes it worth us sending Cyril there. What do we want from it?
No, I hear you, Gareth, and I mean, look, I am never optimistic about those type of pomp and ceremony, banquets, because generally I don't think that they are intended to yield much result. Part of diplomatic work is just a show of force. It's just a show of friendship. It's King Charles III saying, I've got the ability to choose who's my first, you know, guest, and I want South Africa. We are always first in line for some odd reason or the other. Even when former President Zuma came into office, the Queen quickly said, come, Sholozi, join me. There was nothing that was going to come. But you're quite correct to say in the working meetings, because then you have some parallel sessions amongst ministers and so on. In the working sessions, there should be things that we are able to leverage on, like you are saying, Pumi, a health partnership. The NHS, with all its faults and all its problems of being underfunded that politicians in the UK fight about, not enough doctors in hospitals and so on, the NHS works. And because I came from a Commonwealth, when I stayed in Edinburgh, I was on the NHS. I could go and get... when I was going to travel to Kenya from Scotland, I went and got my hepatitis tests done for free. You would never do a test like that here in South Africa for free. So we've got to be able to say, do we have the kind of serious politicians, legislators, and bureaucrats who really mean it when they strike these deals? Because if we were to go to the depository of all these bilateral and multilateral agreements, you'd probably find some very interesting things that have been signed into agreement, have been, envisaged into the future as partnerships. The UK is extremely vulnerable now in terms of its exit from the European Union. I mean, if you've been there in recent times, people are really contending with the issue of inflation. Energy prices were almost going off the roof, and something had to be done about them. Liz Truss, one of the first things that she did when she got into office was that mega £100 billion energy deal, which backfired. But she had no choice but to do it, because you were starting to have households saying that the projection is that we may be paying £6,500 per household on average for energy in the next 6-8 months. Mm-hmm. So they are vulnerable. There are places where we need to plug in holes in those economies. We must not see ourselves only as recipients from these economies. And I think the framing for me, even in the Just Energy Transition, investment program that the president has been championing, is to conceive of us as just mere recipients. Of course, we've got our blackouts and so on. But we've got to also think of how do we fill the gaps. I mean, I was in a conference at the Vatican a few years ago, and one academic protested, it was part of the Pontifical Academy of Social Sciences, and one academic from Italy said, but why are we speaking about a youth we don't have? And I thought, here is an opportunity. Africa has a demographic dividend. You just need to, that the young people are given opportunities, education, skills and training, and it's not just the 2% that we were talking about that is in universities, but we give them the skills in, you know, vocational studies and so on. And suddenly you've got programs of sending some of our young people to go and fill up spaces. Because we're not going to avoid the issue of migration, but how can you do it in a coordinated effort, in a way that, you know, it's about making sure that people are not leaving because conditions are difficult in their countries, but they're actually leaving because they've got something to offer to the world. Japan ran out of truck drivers at some point, and it was a big crisis for the construction industry and the logistics and moving of goods industry. But how are we taking care of those opportunities? Because the Chinese are taking care of opportunities that are in our economy. People from India are taking care of opportunities in the ICT fields and in the diamonds polishing space that are in our country. You name it, all kinds of, I mean, some of the big restaurants here in Johannesburg are not owned by South Africans. They are owned by people from Portugal, people from, you know, your different countries in Europe. So, but what are we doing? What is our agenda to the world rather than, well, you know, the world to us? And that's what I would like to see, Gareth, in those kind of visits.
I also hear you talk about kind of determined bureaucrats that know what is out there. This is one of the issues that we have in our country, is really in that bureaucratic space, not just people who have been deployed. There's much has been done about deployed by a particular party into a space, which is also one of the things that going into 2024 with much talk about coalitions is a very big worry that we have, is are the bureaucrats that we have in our system able to continue working no matter what the political turmoil may look like? Because we don't see that, right? So here in Johannesburg, we have got a coalition government in place that is very fraught with many things. I see Mpopalatsi is facing yet another motion of no confidence. Meanwhile, the rubbish is not getting collected. Like, the work is not getting done, because those individuals who are the bureaucrats who should keep the work running don't do that either. So
this is an important thing. And I said to somebody yesterday, it's part of this denialism that South Africans tend to through. That's why we've always been conditioned. No, it's not a crisis. At all, we can all see there's a crisis.
Mm-hmm.
We are refusing to come up with a piece of legislation that, one, will deal with how coalition governments are, you know, constructed, begin one. Secondly, with the possibility of a national election, for example, you know, with the ANC dropping below 50% in 2024, the problem even becomes more difficult. And one, the first is that you don't have enough time to try and put up these coalition arrangements. And then it leads to the scavenging thing. But we also have not come up with ways, and the National School of Governance, I mean, they talk about it as professionalization of the public sector. And I say to them,
he's also been trying not to come here.
Yeah, you must bring him here and ban him. Because I say to Busani, look, Busani, you can give DGs, for example, directors general, you can give them 10-year contracts. The high turnover and the insecurity of tenure of directors general is not because of how many years they have on their contracts. It's because of the type of politicians who are always trying to interfere with the bureaucracy of their departments, and then they chuck out DGs, or a person arrives at a department, they have a personality clash with a person, and they ask that they be transferred to a different department. So the high turnover of DGs in government is not because their contracts are either 5 years or 10 years. It's because we have not come up with a formula that insulates to a degree our bureaucracy for it to be able to continue to work even with the political machinations. Now, there has been an instability of a bureaucracy without a coalition government at national, right? And I think it will probably worsen with a coalition government if we don't put parameters in place to ensure that the power of politicians, this is where it begins and this is where it ends. They will always tell you, no, we are there to provide a strategic political leadership and guide the policy direction of the department. But behind the scenes, they are pressuring DGs, they are pressuring DDGs to make deals on their behalfs, to appoint service providers that they want, and. And maybe what we also don't have is a platform where DGs can go when they are aggrieved with their bosses. I mean, you saw the fight between Dr. Blade Nzimande and Gwebs Konde, when Gwebs Kwebs was left with like 2 months of his contract. But Zimande was adamant. He's going to suspend him. He wants him fired. Kwebs went to court. Mm. And then and Zimande said he's firing him because of the National Skills Fund audit outcome by the Auditor General. But guess who doesn't want to release the report, the investigative report on the National Skills Fund? It's Plain Zimande. So who was actually the problem around the National Skills Fund issue? So right. We've got to ask these questions and then use the case studies to say there's clearly something rotten here in the sharing of power between the political establishment and the bureaucrats. And we've got to go to other countries and see, you know, how that, you know, division is achieved, division responsibilities, divisions of roles. Yes, there will always be interference. Politicians by nature always want to feel that they've got the final power. Say, they've got the power, they exercise it, you feel it. But as we move towards the possibility of coalitions, some people are now asking, in actual fact, I was responding to an email on my way here, because someone was saying, what of directly electing the president? And I said, well, there's not a commission report. Has made this proposal. Many people fear it for a number of reasons, because of how our country is, inequality, and that it could end up being a contest of billionaires and whatever, people who have money. But theoretically, what it could do is help us not be swallowed by these coalition arrangements. Imagine if you changed presidents as much as the cities of Tswane and of Johannesburg have changed mayors. Presidents have lifetime salaries. Presidents have lifetime security. You would suddenly now be stuck with 10 former presidents. Mm-hmm. And maybe because of the deal-making and the shenanigans of politicians, they could just say, hey, guys, we will give each other this thing in rotation. 1 year it will be you, 1 year it will be you, 1 year it will be... Nothing is beyond politicians. But if you directly elected the president, what you would do if you directly elected the president, you would have to remove Section 102 of the Constitution, which is the motion of no confidence. Because Parliament can't lose confidence on a person that they did not elect. Right? Correct. And you would keep Section 89, which is our version of an impeachment clause, mm-hmm. because Section 89 has a far higher threshold. 2/3 of parliament must vote in favor of removing the president rather right. than 50% plus one. So you've got to start thinking about these governance issues in anticipation of mischief politically, because we have seen it. And there's no reason to believe that at a national level, the political mischief that prevails in local government will not be there.
So which brings us maybe for the last little bit to a really an ongoing discussion, but one that the Rivonia Circle is actively involved in, and it's in direct representation and change the electorate.
Oh no no.
Welele.
That one. Look, I mean, I think they now agree. I think the ANC, again, I'll use that word for your entertainment, Pumi. The ANC ecosystem now agrees that it has been wrong on this issue. They've also been lambasted by former presidents of the ANC, former President Mbeki. 2 weeks ago in the Sunday Times, there was a massive column of an interview with former President Kgalema Motlanthe.
Mm-hmm.
And because they know that the current arrangement was transitional in nature, because of where we were in 1993, to create a democratic breakthrough moment, you needed to make sure that there is much possibility for everybody to be represented, one, in parliament, and partly because parties generally were quite insular in terms of their interests. You know, you had the Mangopes who were interested in their, you know, carrying on their legacy from the Bantustan. You had your minority France for Indian people. So you need to create a system that would make it possible for, one, everybody to want to participate, but also feel that they had an opportunity for representation in parliament. And then when the clause for the government of national unity was put in place, it was not a coalition government. The ANC had over 50%. But again, it was to say there has to be a degree of collaboration because of where we are coming from. And any party that had, I think, over 10 seats in parliament could be part of the government of national unity. And the NNP was there, the IFP was there, and so on. Now, however, There was a commitment to say we would have to envisage, one, a truly representative electoral system. Secondly, an accountable electoral system, and thirdly, a localized electoral system that is closest to the people. Now, the fact that they sometimes use the argument that says, yeah, but people don't even know who their ward councillors, who their ward councillors are, is neither here nor there. Doesn't matter whether I know who my ward councillor is. The fact that if I do want to find them, I would know exactly who represents my constituents if I do need to find them, if I do need to talk to them. Don't always have to talk to them, right? But now, what is at stake is not the inclusion of independent candidates. What they are running away from is that we are about to crack open the closed party lists. Because a party can say, this is our 200 MPs going to the election, and you think, brilliant people. And then they get their seats, and now they have to deploy, and they say, oh, no. These people are not available. Now, these are going to be your parliamentarians. Now, I'll give you an example in my town, a small town of Flagstaff in the Eastern Cape. They are also my relatives. The Kappas. They are both members of parliament, right? The husband was on the regional to national list, Eastern Cape to national, and the wife, Deputy Minister Zoleka Kappa, was on the national to national list. Now, suddenly, the ANC has to make a choice between the two. Who's going to stand for them in that constituency? It's now no longer automatic that both husband and wife can go and be representatives in parliament. They must make a choice. So partly why there is resistance to the electoral reform agenda is because it's going to present some political parties with headaches. They know that, I can imagine Faith Mutambi trying to win her constituency in Limpopo to send her to parliament. I don't think she would get it. But she's chairperson of her portfolio committee now. She's secured. So once you start creating that competitiveness in the elections, unfortunately, some people are going to lose out. Some are not even known in their communities. I mean, Cyril would have to make a choice whether he resides in Shiawelo or Hyde Park, and whether he can win if he was to represent a community around Hyde Park. I mean, he doesn't live in an ANC ward, right? So these are the current problems that people are grappling with, because it becomes a point of vulnerability. Because what if I can't win the constituencies? And as we have been seeing with local government elections, once you introduce a direct election constituency system, you also make competitive the proportional representation list. So you've had parties like the EFF, for example, represented in the city of Johannesburg without even winning a ward. But they've got councillors in council. So this idea that small parties would die is also false. It's also false. They say, no, we keep the proportional representation because small parties will die. Rubbish. There's direct representation in the city of Etekwini. There are 18 parties. They have 23 seats amongst themselves. So small parties don't die simply because you change the electoral system. What you make complex, though, in national elections is because of the viability of national elections, the prestige of national elections. There are now people who are not in politics who would suddenly want to contest in their constituencies. Maybe a Tulima Donzela could say, my parting shot to South Africa is to just represent a constituency in parliament, and I will be a legislator and make sure that the laws of the country are to the competence that we require them. Now, suddenly, some mediocre politician has to be toe-to-toe with the Tulima Donzela, and you increase the competitiveness of the system.
Absolutely.
And that's what the ANC in particular does not want.
And they're dragging
them. Including their fellow travelers, the PAC, EFF, and Al Jamaa.
Well, I couldn't think of a better note to end it on.
Do you want a mic
Gareth,
to
you're
drop?
Mute.
Do you want a mic to drop?
I can't think of a better way to end this, actually. I've got to say, Lukhona, such a pleasure to have not only the refreshing ideas that you've brought. We have not discussed, and we've been doing the Burning Platform for years now, but the one thing we haven't got to discussing is some of the stuff that you've just brought up now about competent legislative politicians who are elected in independent roles, but also the idea of having a president who's directly elected, which we haven't ever discussed before. Reforming the systems that don't work. I love this stuff. You've really made me think. There are plenty of comments from people who I haven't even been able to put up on screen, just agreeing with you, wanting to hear more from you. I mean, this is the work of the Rivonia Circle, and you can find out more from Lukhona and his other Lukhona and his other friends at the Rivonia Circle, some of whom we hope to have join us again soon. But you have been a real winner this morning, so thank you for coming and being part of the show.
Oh, Thank you. Thank you for the candid conversation and reflections, Gareth and Pumi. Really, really enjoyed it, interrogating some of, you know, our assumptions, some of the work that we do.
Sure.
But also just giving us an opportunity to share some ideas. And I do think, Gareth, that the greatest work that we've got to do going forward is to really think carefully about the kind of state reforms that we need that may put us on a different course and journey as a country. So thank you so much for this morning.
I love it.
It doesn't always have to be in the DMs that you get.
Yes,
and it's on the street.
And I must say that Kay Kwanele KZ has already come and said, I dragged you and not Pumi, so Pumi, you're protected.
All right, thank you everybody, and have an excellent Thursday.
Thank you so much.
We will join you again.
Have a lovely day.
Thank you, Lukwana. And we will see you again next Thursday for the Burning Platform. And in the meantime, don't forget that we're on tomorrow morning, bright and early at 6 a.m. right here on cliffcentral.com. Cheers, everybody. Bye-bye.
Cliffcentral.com.